outside and in the clerk's office and are available for inspection. Justices Spears and Ray will not be here this morning, but will participate in the deliberation and decisions in the causes to be submitted today. We have three causes on our schedule for submission. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Tarrant County Hospital District and others versus Armendariz and others from Tarrant County. The State of Texas versus the Honorable Pete Lowry, an original mandamus proceeding. And ex parte William Evans Pryor, an original habeas corpus proceeding. We have allotted 15 minutes for each side to present argument and 5 minutes for rebuttal in the first and third causes, and 20 minutes for each side to present argument and 5 minutes for rebuttal in the second cause. Counsel in the second and third causes do not have to remain in the courtroom while earlier matters are being presented, but we ask that you remain nearby so that we may proceed to your matter without delay in the event we finish before schedule. We are recording these arguments for the convenience of the court. If anyone desires to listen to tape recordings of these arguments, you may make application to do so with our clerk, Mr. John Adams. The court is now ready to hear argument from petitioner, Tarrant County Hospital District, in the first cause.
May I please the court, Mr. Sullivan Bradley, and Ms. Deanna Gardner, petitioner, Mr. Sullivan Bradley, welcome.
May it please the court, learned counsel. This case is a medical malpractice case. It arises from the May 1983 admission of plaintiff Rachel Armendariz to the hospital of the Tarrant County Hospital District. That hospital is known as John Peter Smith Hospital. It's located in Fort Worth, Texas. Mrs. Armendariz was admitted there for the purpose of treating her labor and for the delivery of her child, Alan Armendariz, who is a minor plaintiff in this case. Mrs. Armendariz and her husband, Richard, have sued the Tarrant County Hospital District and the defendant physicians, Garcia, Schlock, and Lozano, alleging negligence that caused injury to minor plaintiff Alan Armendariz. The basic allegations, as we see it, are that the physicians should have done a cesarean section delivery as opposed to a vaginal delivery of this child. It's uncontested that the defendant physicians were employed by the Tarrant County Hospital District to provide medical care to its patients. It's uncontested in the case that the hospital district is, a tort claims entity protected by the doctrine of sovereign immunity generally. All defendants filed motions for summary judgment in the case, which were granted by the trial court. The hospital district had contended that the plaintiffs had failed to plead and prove a case to the level of summary judgment burden with regard to a use or condition of tangible property as provided by the Tort Claims Act, so that there was no proximately caused use or condition of tangible property causing injury to the child. Defendant physicians contended that, in fact, in the facts of this case, they were public employees, governmental employees, those of the Tarrant County Hospital District, acting in the course and scope of their duties in good faith throughout the course of their involvement with the plaintiffs, and as such, they were immune under the doctrine of official immunity. The trial court granted the motions of all defendants, plaintiffs' appeals, asserting 12 points of error. Plaintiffs, with regard to the Tarrant County Hospital District, had made three allegations of negligence involving the use or condition of tangible property. The first two being a failure to properly interpret prenatal delivery records and a failure to properly follow procedure manuals of the hospital, resulting in a failure to do a C-section. The Court of Appeals agreed with the trial court that there was no summary judgment evidence put forth to support those contentions. We believe that is the case, and we respectfully petition the court to so agree. Plaintiffs also alleged that there was a negligent use of a piece of equipment referred to as a vacuum extractor during the course of the labor and delivery of Alan Armendariz. again, alleging that the use of that extractor caused injury to the child. Plaintiff's point of error was based on the allegation, and it was the sole point of error upon which the Court of Appeals, with regard to its reversal of the judgment in favor of the Tarrant County Hospital District, acted. The Court of Appeals found that there was summary judgment evidence sufficient to raise a fact issue as to whether or not the use of the vacuum extractor approximately caused the injury. We contend that the court erred in that regard. That is the basis of our point of error number one in the district's application to this court. The Court of Appeals also found that defendant physicians were not entitled to the protection of official immunity. In so doing, the Court of Appeals made the specific finding that there had been no demonstration by these defendants that their duties acting in this case were demonstrated to be uniquely governmental or different from those in their private sector counterpart. We submit that the addition or the introduction of this is a criteria to the previously existing three-pronged test for official immunity. Basically ignores a long line of Texas common law with regard to the doctrine, and as such, it constitutes error on the part of the Court of Appeals. That essentially is the district's point of error number three with regard to its application before this court.
Well, in that regard, the Court of Appeals seems to characterize, perhaps not in exactly these terms, the position that it took as being the majority rule among the states, that medical doctors employed by the government don't enjoy official immunity. Is it the majority rule?
I would not be surprised, Your Honor, if in fact it was. I'm not prepared to give the court a specific number with regard to whether it is a majority. It certainly is a well-recognized doctrine. I'll grant that. With regard to the rule of existing case law in the Texas courts, we contend that it specifically contravenes a long-existing stretch of common law. It's an additional element that has not been required until this court set it forth. It appears, at least to this attorney, that has been done with specific regard to the category of physicians as public employees.
So in essence, what you're asking us to do is to carve out an exception here in Texas that doesn't apply in most other states so that medical doctors will be immunized through official immunity.
What we're asking the court to do, Your Honor, if I may, is essentially recognize and follow and require the Court of Appeals to recognize and follow a prior and long-existing doctrine that has existed in the state of Texas.
Well, as far as that prior and long-existing doctrine, there's really only one case, is there not, that has actually considered the question of medical doctors and getting official immunity?
To my knowledge, there is not even a single case that is very clearly said specifically that physicians are going to be considered officially immune with regard to the type of facts that are in place in this particular case. It is our contention that there should, and there is no logical basis for setting aside a separate category under which physicians are going to be required to comply with and produce evidence supporting this additional criteria.
Well, the case I'm referring to that I think you're familiar with is Gleason against Biesinger. Doesn't it, it's a federal district case from last year, doesn't it go just the opposite of what you're urging the court to do and follow the majority rule that physicians don't enjoy official immunity?
I'll tell you quite frankly that I'm here at this moment, I'm not sufficiently familiar with the facts of that case, Judge.
Okay.
With regard to the hospital district point of error number one before the court today, specifically I'm referring to the use or condition of tangible property allegation on which the Court of Appeals reversed the trial court's judgment. We submit to the court that there was indeed no evidence before the trial court. There is no evidence discernible and available to the Court of Appeals supporting the contention that the use of a vacuum extractor in this case caused injury to Alan Orman Derricks. All the evidence before the court, that provided by the defendant physicians in the case and that provided by the expert witness of the plaintiffs in the case, contends that this piece of equipment is utilized to facilitate and maintain the descension of the fetus as it passes through the birth canal. It is not utilized, again, this testimony is corroborated by the testimony of plaintiff's expert, to pull or draw the fetus through the birth canal. The natural pressures expanded by the mother in pushing the child through the canal move the baby downward. When it gets to a point where she is about to relax, the physician utilizes, again, this testimony is provided by Dr. Garcia, one of the defendants, corroborated by Dr. Lester, the plaintiff's witness. The physician utilizes the vacuum extractor solely to maintain that position. In other words, not to give up what the mother has already gained. At the time, on the facts of this case, the child's head was delivered. The vacuum extractor was discontinued. That is the usual and regular course in vaginal deliveries where this type of extractor is utilized. Excuse me. Up until that point, again, we're talking about, I believe the evidence demonstrates clearly, a normal vaginal delivery. There has been no injury incurred by minor plaintiff Alan Armendariz. The child's head has been delivered. The physician has set aside the piece of equipment that's become in question in this case. The physician utilizes his hands to exert downward pressure. Again, the testimony is corroborated by the plaintiff's expert witness to deliver the shoulders and body of the child. It's at this point when the physician determined that a shoulder dystocia was developing, that being the condition where the anterior presenting shoulder of the child is hooking up on or being blocked by the symphysis pubis of the mother. At that particular point, this physician continued to exert downward pressure on the child's head, again, using nothing but his hands. The piece of equipment has been set aside and discontinued. And the child was effectively delivered. The testimony of Dr. Garcia and, again, of the plaintiff's expert witness was that there were alternate mechanisms that could have been utilized by such a physician delivering a child in this type of condition. Again, it would not utilize specific types of equipment. We're talking about manipulation with the surgeon's hands, the body of the child in different ways in an attempt to free the shoulder and facilitate the delivery. This physician never got to that point. What we had essentially was a normal vaginal delivery where at most the plaintiff can argue there was damage to the brachial plexus of the child's arm, nerve damage, that was incurred during the course of this delivery. There was no equipment being utilized at that point. There was no equipment being utilized to facilitate that delivery at the immediate time prior to that point. We believe the law in Texas is that plaintiffs have to prove that a use or condition of equipment was the proximate cause of the injury in this case. That has not been done. Again, I believe that is this contention is corroborated by the testimony of plaintiff's expert, Dr. Lester.
Counsel, you said there were alternate mechanisms that could have been used. What did you mean by that?
I believe Dr. Lester and Dr. Garcia, who was one of the co-defendants in the case, testified that there were other alternatives if the generally used downward pressure failed to facilitate a delivery that a delivering physician might go to. Those, again, would basically involve the physician using his hand and turning the child, trying to deliver one portion of the child or another. They would not involve the use of any further type of equipment, if I recall the testimony correctly, and I believe I do. We never got to that point in this case because the routinely applied downward pressure using the hands of the delivering physician facilitated the delivery.
Wasn't the decision to use the vacuum extractor in the first place based on a misreading or a misuse of the charts?
That has been, I believe, late in the case, one of the contentions of the plaintiffs. It was considered by the trial court at the time of the motion for summary judgment. It was determined by the court that there was no evidence, no summary judgment proof in evidence indicating that that was the case. I believe that, in fact, is the case. The Court of Appeals agreed, incidentally. There is no evidence put forth, even by the expert witness, Dr. Lester, plaintiff's expert witness, indicating that was the case.
Why aren't the prenatal records and the obstetrics manual tangible property?
Well, they certainly are tangible property, Your Honor. I feel sure that would be the case, as would be the delivery table that Ms. Armendariz was resting upon and the overhead light that was being utilized to illuminate the operative area. There is never going to be a case, whether there is a negligent act or omission or not, where some type of tangible property is not going to come into play. The question, as we see it, and I believe it was well put by Justice Meyer in his dissenting opinion to the Court of Appeals opinion in this case, we're talking about the use of tangible property that proximately causes the injury. There's always going to be, any time a patient goes into a hospital, a use of tangible property. There's no question about that. Did I respond sufficiently to your question?
Thank you.
Thank you. Again, we believe Justice Meyer put it well. This point is corroborated by the testimony of Dr. Lester, the plaintiff's expert witness. He had no problem and thought it was done properly. I'm referring specifically to the use of the extractor.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
Can't take the court. Mr. Lawrence Christian for the respondent.
Your Honor, if I may, I believe we were allotted 15 minutes. I suspect half of it has gone by, and Ms. Gardner did have some.
All of it has gone by.
All of it's gone by.
I beg your pardon.
This is, Your Honors, an appeal from a summary judgment. As such, the facts must be taken as true. Those facts demonstrate that the defendant doctors in the hospital, in this case, negligently failed to do a cesarean section in treating Rachel Armendariz, with the result that her son was developed shoulder dystocia, where his shoulder became stuck and he had to be forcibly removed, and an injury occurred. And the medical evidence in the case by Dr. Joseph Gaines, the treating doctor who has followed him orthopedically, indicates that in his whole life he will never be able to lift more than a pound with that arm. Therefore, at this point, the summary judgment proof clearly demonstrates negligence on the part of the defendant doctors and hospital, resulting in lifelong injuries to Alan Armendariz. But despite that fact, the petitioners come into the court asking the court to hold that official immunity precludes any cause of action against the doctors, and that governmental or sovereign immunity precludes any cause of action against the hospital district, thereby leaving Alan Armendariz, a poor child who had no choice in the place he was born, with no remedy for these grievous ailments that he will suffer on a lifelong basis. I'd like to talk first about official immunity. I believe that contrary to what the petitioners would have you believe, that Texas does follow the discretionary versus ministerial analysis, and that is all that the Court of Appeals in Fort Worth was doing when it wrote its opinion, was making a ministerial versus discretionary analysis and concluding, in effect, that the duties of doctors, who are only rendering the practice of medicine, are only rendering medical treatment and nothing more, falls into the ministerial category and is therefore non-immune. I think it was an appropriate inquiry and an appropriate analysis. There are three Texas cases that have discussed this doctrine before, aside to the one that Justice Doggett alluded to, the Biesinger case, which is a federal district court case, which does indeed hold exactly the opposite of what the petitioners would have this court hold. But there are three cases that have talked about the doctrine before: Baker versus Story, Brown versus Prairie View, and Salcedo versus Diaz. In none of those cases did the court reach the question. They said the summary judgment proof or the proof before the court is not well enough developed for us to make a decision whether this is ministerial or discretionary, therefore we're sending it back. In this case, we do have a lot of depositions. The case was fairly far along. There's plenty of evidence from which a court could make a decision. It doesn't need to be remanded.
Would every professional in government service be performing ministerial duties under that analysis?
I don't.
Surveyors?
Generally speaking, people that are just doing their day-to-day duties, whether they're professional or non-professional or ministerial, unless their decision has some governmental impact or is a policy-type decision or so forth. For example, in the medical area, you take the Nowotny case, which the petitioners have cited. That is a case in which the court held that the discretionary duties did apply to a couple of psychiatrists at the University of Texas Health Center who testified about the mental condition of a student who was raising a ruckus on campus. And they apparently testified that he was a danger and he was removed from the campus and later brought up a case against them and other university officials. The Austin Court of Appeals said that that was a, in that case, these were doctors, psychiatrists, but in that case they were indeed performing discretionary function, so they were immune because their decision had an impact on the safety of the students at the university. So whether it's a professional...
Does that analysis really hold up? Couldn't you argue just as well here that these doctors were safeguarding the, or trying to safeguard the physical health of the community, of the impoverished?
Well, you can make that argument, but as a general rule, their main duties as medical doctors who have patients that they're treating is to take care of the patient. And I really think that's their only duty when they're engaged in essentially what doctors in private practice would be doing.
So you would draw a line that you have to, if the decision impacts a large number of people, like you're making a policy decision that we will perform cesareans in these types of situations, then that would be discretionary. Or you make a decision we ought to give flu vaccines this year because of epidemics coming through. That would be discretionary.
I believe
you're treating one individual patient.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. I believe if a decision was made about flu vaccine and somebody didn't get the flu vaccine, got the flu because of the decision, got the flu and died, I believe that would be a discretionary function, and under the Fort Worth Court of Appeals analysis and all the other courts that have considered it, that would indeed be...
That's the line that you see being drawn in the, in what you believe is the majority of jurisdictions.
Yes, it is, Your Honor, as a matter of fact. I think that the Fort Worth Court of Appeals here has not created a new basis for liability. And in saying that they have, the petitioners are essentially setting up a straw man, which they now want this court to knock over for them. I believe that contrary to the Fort Worth Court of Appeals coming up with new law, the petitioners want this court to engage in a little judicial activism and create a new defense, absolute immunity for governor doctors without regard to whether their duties are discretionary or ministerial. There's only one other jurisdiction that has done that, and that's the state of Mississippi in the Chawla case, which is cited. Mississippi forthrightly concedes in Chawla that their view is a minority view, and they say, nevertheless, that in order to provide services to the poor, they're going to do that. I submit that's bad policy. It shouldn't be followed in Texas. It isn't good. It is not good for the poor to provide substandard medical care. And care that is substandard is no care at all. And to immunize that type of liability for that, or doctors from liability for that type of care, is not good policy. I submit the Fort Worth Court of Appeals was correct in refusing to follow Chawla. Most courts have indeed held that the routine practice of medicine is ministerial, not discretionary, and therefore no immunity applies. The minority view is that the routine practice of medicine may sometimes involve duties which are ministerial. The only other jurisdiction that I've found that is really close to Mississippi on this is Michigan, and they cite the Mudo case, which also cites a number of related cases. In one of those, they made a decision that a doctor, insofar as he decided when to do blood pressure and medication tests, that was ministerial, but or rather was discretionary and immune, but insofar as whether he followed the treatment plan or not, that was ministerial, so immunity would not lie. It isn't that Michigan doesn't follow the discretionary versus ministerial analysis. It's just they go a little bit more further, a little bit further on the discretionary side than most other jurisdictions. Chawla is the only one that has said across the board that there's immunity in all cases. Now, the federal government had a case that said that government doctors were not immune, Henderson versus Blue Mink out of the D.C. Circuit, and they passed the federal act, the Federal Immunity or Malpractice Immunity Act, I believe is the title or something like that, which extends immunity to all government doctors. But That is done legislatively and not judicially. Besides, the federal government, through the Tort Claims Act, extends a full and fair remedy that can completely make whole anyone that's injured. The same can certainly not be said of our Texas Tort Claims Act, which is so fraught with problems and immunities and artificial distinctions that it's virtually useless in a lot of cases.
Has this court ever recognized this discretionary versus ministerial concept, going back to the official immunity?
I think that in non-medical situations, this court essentially applies it all the time. I don't know if the Texas Supreme Court has or not.
The cases you cited are appeals cases. So is it we have a three-pronged test, which this is not part of, isn't that correct? But the courts of appeals, looking at the majority view in other states, have done this. Is that a fair statement of the law?
I believe that's right, Your Honor.
So it's an open question for us.
I believe it is indeed, although I think that the rule is of ancient enough application through the courts of appeals that it's fairly well established, but I believe it is an open question for this court. I'd like to... There's a number of jurisdictions that do hold that the routine practice of medicine is ministerial, which is all that the respondents are asking for here. Among them, Kansas, Wisconsin, Illinois, Missouri, Oregon, Georgia, and Utah. And if you follow the Biesinger case, the federal case in which Judge Lake over at Houston decided what he believed the law of Texas was, Texas is in that camp right now. Of course, that's a federal case, not controlling.
Your green light's on and the time's beginning to wind down, and so much of the focus of your opposing counsel was on this use question. Tell me what tangible property was misused that was the proximate cause of injury.
All right, we have three essential things here. The prenatal and delivery room records, the hospital procedure manuals, and the vacuum extractor. The Fort Worth court held that the use of the manuals and the records was a non-use, and their decision was written before this court's decision in Robinson, I believe. But they held it was a non-use. I think under Salcedo versus Diaz, they should have held even that was a use. And they inexplicably ignored Salcedo versus Diaz and didn't even put it in their opinion. I can't understand why the Fort Worth court did that. They should at least have talked about Salcedo versus Diaz, because I believe that's a case on all fours that would stand for the proposition that failure to properly interpret and apply the procedure manuals and delivery room manuals was a use. As far as the vacuum extractor is concerned...
Can we go on to that, to the next item? Is there evidence in some just proof that the use of those records was approximate cause of the injuries?
As this court said in Justice Campbell's opinion in Salcedo versus Diaz, the way you use the records is by interpreting and applying them. Summary judgment proof from the plaintiff's doctor, Dr. Lester, indicates that the data gathered in the prenatal process should have called for a cesarean section. And also, the hospital procedure manuals identified certain high-risk categories, such as preeclampsia. The summary judgment proof showed this lady had preeclampsia, and yet she was never referred to the high-risk or complications clinic the way that the procedure manual should say. I think it's fair that if she had been, more experienced doctors would have been involved and a cesarean section would probably have been done. I believe there is summary judgment proof along those lines, Your Honor. I'd like to speak in the few remaining minutes I have about the Justice Myers' comment that there's no proximate cause here. He says that the use of the extractor didn't cause the injury to Allen Armendariz. What caused the injury to Allen Armendariz was the birth canal. That is, to me, a rather disingenuous argument, because the test that you use in under numerous cases, including Nixon and other cases of this court, is first you have to determine if it's foreseeable, then you have to determine its cause in fact, and the cause in fact analysis is essentially whether the negligence was a substantial factor in the injury. If you use a vacuum extractor to deliver the head, when all of the evidence that you're seeing and the progress of labor should be pointing towards cesarean section, you use the vacuum extractor to deliver the head, and then that is past the point of no return and you can't go back and do a cesarean section, I don't believe it's too far-fetched to say that indeed was the proximate cause. I'd like to talk about Nixon versus Mr. Crofty, in which failure to board up the building was a substantial factor in a rape and therefore met the cause in fact analysis. Of course, boarding up the building did not cause the rape. If you want to analogize with Justice Meyer's dissent in the Court of Appeals in this case, the boarding up of the building did not cause the rape. What caused the rape was the act of a third party, a rapist. And yet the failure to board the building was still a substantial factor. And for that reason, did meet the proximate cause-in-fact analysis. Likewise, I cited MP versus Missouri Pacific versus American Statesman, where failure to erection of a tram in violation of statutory clearance requirements met the but-for test. The McClure case, where negligent pursuit of a shoplifter who knocked a customer down, the negligence in pursuing the shoplifter met the but-for test. So if you apply this analysis, I believe there's no question that but for the use of the vacuum extractor, the only alternative, Mr. Bradley talked about alternatives here. He said there were other alternatives, Woods maneuver and so forth and so on, which he was describing, which is a screw type movement to try to remove the baby. The only real alternative was one of those maneuvers or else the use of the vacuum extractor. The other alternative and the most viable alternative was to do the cesarean section. When these other maneuvers were used, or when the vacuum extractor was used and the head was delivered, it was no longer possible to go back and do those other things. Therefore, I believe the use of the extractor was a substantial cause of the accident. It does meet the.
What is your response to the argument that the extractor was no more involved in the injury in this case than the table she was lying on or the lights overhead?
Well, I just don't believe that that's true, because the extractor was used in a positive manner. It was used to grab hold of the baby and move it to a point at which it was no longer possible to do a cesarean section. The lights
there was
overhead,
no injury by that. Okay, go ahead.
The lights overhead and the table weren't used in that way. They were simply passive there. The extractor was used in a positive manner to move the baby past the point of no return. That's a use. I note in the Robinson case there was a dissent that said that non-use versus use applied, or that would preserve the distinction between use and non-use. I think with regard to all of these things, the extractor and the use of the records, that we're talking about non-use, or rather use, even under the dissent in Robinson, so I don't feel that should be a problem. I see my time's expired. I thank the court for this opportunity to present.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, Carol.
May it please the court that Dan Gardner will present the rebuttal.
May it please the court, counsel. I'd like to make one comment about the holding of the Court of Appeals and commenting that the doctors moved the child with the vacuum extractor. That is a mischaracterization of the testimony. The testimony from the doctors in the record is that the child was moved by the contractions of the mother in the course of the normal delivery process. Once that process was when the doctors decided to use that process, it took its normal course. The mother gives birth to the baby. That's simple, basic biology. The doctors testified that they used the vacuum extractor to maintain the head at the level to which she brought it in the birth canal by her contractions to keep, because her contractions were not strong enough to maintain the descent to eventually push the baby out. They used it to maintain the head, but it was the mother's contractions which pushed the baby into the position where it became impacted on the pelvic bone, causing the shoulder dystocia, which in turn then caused, when the baby was delivered, the shoulder injury. I'd like to go on to the question of official immunity and make a couple of comments about that, and specifically with respect to your question, Mr. Justice Doggett, about the line of cases upon which the Court of Appeals relied. That is not a majority rule. There are about five states in the whole United States that have adopted the rule that there must be a uniquely governmental function being performed by an employee in order to utilize the doctrine of official immunity. And if you read each of those cases carefully, a couple of them involve states which do not even recognize the doctrine of official immunity for public employees at all. They limit it to public officials for one reason or another. The other states rely, in my opinion, wrongly upon a group of federal cases in which have interpreted the statutory exemption from liability for the federal government in the Federal Tort Claims Act, the discretionary function exemption. And that's an entirely different exemption. It was created by Congress. It was copied by Texas and most other states in our Texas Tort Claims Act, and we have a Texas decision interpreting that statute, Texas Supreme Court decision, Terrell versus State.
Well, is Mississippi the only state that supports the point of view that you're urging on the court today?
No, Your Honor, it is not. Michigan has one of the best decisions, and I have the Cannon versus Thurmondo, which was the Supreme Court of Michigan decision, which I've discussed in my brief, that the Court of Appeals had wrongly cited the Michigan lower appellate court opinion in its original opinion, which was reversed by the Michigan Supreme Court. And they have also correctly analyzed the law, and they have realized that those other states that say that there must be some uniquely governmental function are borrowing a test that was not intended to be used for official immunity at all. The two discretionary immunities have entirely different backgrounds. They come from entirely different sources, and they have different purposes. That's where you will find the discussion of the separation of powers doctrine as being one of the bases for immunity. That has nothing to do with official immunity. That has to do with whether the federal government should sit in judgment on policy decisions of the executive and legislative branches, and that is one of the reasons why Congress has chosen to have the United States government retain its immunity in the situations where there are basic policy decisions being made. And that argument has no application to official immunity. Even Justice Hill in the Court of Appeals' original opinion recognizes that there's one basic purpose for the doctrine of official immunity, and it's very simple and direct, and that is to encourage men and women to enter government service and to allow them to fearlessly perform their jobs without the fear of lawsuits.
But even if you don't apply the uniquely governmental test, why weren't the doctors in this case performing ministerial functions in the sense that they were non-policy makers?
Your Honor, because under Texas law and under the law in every other state, I believe, that I think almost all states follow the basic common law rule that the difference between ministerial and discretionary is that discretionary duties require personal deliberation, decision, and judgment. It's very simple. And that ministerial are only those decisions of public employees, not necessarily officials, but all employees, which require obedience to orders and which do not leave them with any choice. The Texas courts have never made a distinction based upon governmental, a requirement that the duty be uniquely governmental, and I think you'll find that the decisions do not support any such distinction. And if you apply such a distinction, you virtually abolish the doctrine of official immunity, because in this day and time, most public employees do not make basic policy decisions. Those decisions are made by administrative heads, boards, legislators, and judges, and those individuals are entitled to absolute immunity.
Any other questions?
Let me ask you just one more. How can we square your view on the use issue with our decisions in Saucedo and Robinson?
Your Honor, I believe that those decisions involved a condition of property and not use. I think those can be squared in that way. Plus, additionally, I think that the only evidence of any use of property in this case was of the vacuum extractor, and it was undisputed that the vacuum extractor was properly used. Even the plaintiff's expert testified to that. and that the essence of the plaintiff's complaint is that a wrong decision was made to perform, not to perform a cesarean section.
Thank you,
Your Honor. Thank you for letting me appear.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first call. The court will take a brief recess.